That's apologies for that bug, everybody. I don't know what that was. Are we being hacked? Anyway, we're gonna press on. I'm Johnny DiRola. Jordan Yule joins us on the Damage Report. How's it going, Jordan Yule?
Oh, John, I couldn't be better.
Yeah. I had a feeling that you would be excited about the news. And as everyone I think out there knows, knowing you, I'm talking about the Elon Musk story. Obviously, that's going to be important news. But no, today is like a historic day. It's a day that many people, I think, were waiting for. So they express their thoughts about one of the most controversial figures in American political history. I think that Jordan is near the top of that list. So very excited to have you on the show today, Jordan. Thank you. And for all of you out there, thank you for joining us as well. In addition to obviously, you know, the Kissinger related stuff, which we're going to get to in just a little bit. We're going to be talking about apologists for the massive civilian casualties in Gaza. Elon Musk maybe like reaching the edge. He seems in a dark place, and we're going to be playing video to demonstrate that. The UAW's planned next steps, I think, are incredibly exciting, and so we're going to get to that. And today could be like sort of D-Day for George Santos. So he has one final act that he wants to make in Congress. We're going to be talking about that. And then there's a billion other important things to get to too. So thank you for joining us. Please hit the like button, share the stream if you haven't already. And as always, we love your comments. We love your super chats and all of that. Send them in and you might just get a $100 Blue Apron gift card. We'll be choosing one through the course of today's show. But with all that said, Jordan, are you ready to start the show?
John, I was born ready.
You were born ready. It's on your Wikipedia bio. Anyway, let's jump into this. At the ripe age of 100, Henry Kissinger, one of the most controversial, noteworthy secretaries of state and, you know, arguably war criminals, has passed. He made it to 100 because that's the way the world works. Doesn't make any sense. There's no rhyme or reason. There's no baked in ethics to any of it, but he made it to 100 and he has now passed. You can see a photo of him right here. Now, at a time like this, when someone who has been so big in American politics for so long, it is important to give them credit for what they were able to accomplish. He advised, I think, 12 presidents. And so we're going to be critical of him, obviously, but I want to give him credit for some of his most important contributions. So he helped prolong the Vietnam War. That's great. Expanding that conflict into neutral Cambodia, facilitated genocides in Cambodia, East Timor, and Bangladesh, accelerated civil wars in Southern Africa, supported coups and death squads throughout Latin America. And according to one analysis, can be fairly directly given the responsibility for the deaths of 3 million plus people, which is that's a lot. I mean, that's very difficult for anyone. Veteran war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody said there were, quote, few people who have had a hand in as much death and destruction, as much human suffering in so many places around the world as Henry Kissinger. And, you know, just I'm not an expert on Henry Kissinger's life or anything like that. And there's amazing books in journalism done on his record. But I will just say that it would be a difficult task, not impossible, but a difficult task to come up with many more people who were more responsible for more suffering, death, devastation than Henry Kissinger. And perhaps even harder than that, it would be almost impossible to find someone who had done more damage and had expressed less regret through the course of his incredibly long life than Henry Kissinger for his whirlwind tour around the globe of supporting almost all of the, you know, regressive, horrendous, violent political movements, piling up mountains of corpses, thanks to his direct advocacy and direct control. So, bye. Anyway, Jordan, what do you think? Henry Kissinger finally died.
What if the evil ones always live so long? Like, that's my 100 question.
Years old. I'm not going to hit 50. And he reached 100.
I'm just going to start to accept like the baby blood drinking conspiracy just because that's the only thing that makes sense anymore.
Adrenochrome?
People live forever. Yeah, why not? At this point, like what? Just prove it. No, but on a serious note, it is. Yeah, sure. It's. Yeah, we're celebrating this guy died, but like nothing changes. And he still accomplished everything that he wanted. And that's the frustrating part. You know, there were no checks and balances. There was no accountability for anything that he did, anything he supported, anything he lied about in Congress, even like the week that the U.S. was doing it under his guidance or instruction, including in Chile, just lying about U.S. involvement. the week of. No remorse, like you said. And yeah, it's always like fun to celebrate when evil people with terrible legacies die. But more often than not, it's at the end of their life surrounded by family and peace and quiet with having no punishment for anything they did. No trial, no persecution, nothing. And that's frustrating. And it reflects a systemic problem that people like that can go their entire lives committing unspeakable atrocities and unspeakable acts of violence, killing in this case and being responsible for millions of deaths around the world, governments overthrown, leaders tossed out, people tortured, long-lasting generational effects because of one person, and nothing happens. And that's the systemic problem. We have a system where the powerful elite celebrate, defend, welcome that person and protect them for decades. It paves the way for other people like him, like Elliot Abrams. Never going to face any real repercussions for anything that he's done. He's still getting government positions. He's still in prominent positions. He's still got access to people in power. So yeah, it's good he died, but like nothing ever came his way that would punish him or even slightly frustrate him for anything that he did.
That is true. Thank you, Buzz Killington, for pointing out those unfortunate truths. Yes. Now, you're keeping it real. You 100% are. And there are some people in the audience, you know, I love you all, who believe that, sure, he didn't suffer any consequences before his death, but perhaps after it, there is something, some formulation of an afterlife where he will face some sort of judgment. I unfortunately can't fall back on that, but this is one of the few times where I kind of wish I could, you know, unfortunately I can't. So he did what he did. He was criticized for decades. And I think that, you know, as time went on, more and more people understood who he was and what his real legacy was. But it never, as Jordan points out, really mattered all that much, aside from some student protests and a couple critical documentaries. You know, as late as like 2016, Hillary Clinton was still like, yeah, he's my good friend. He's my inspiration. He's why I wanted to get in this. Like, Jesus. And was still, you know, getting awards and giving speeches and going to dinners and living it up, basically, despite a truly historic level of devastation all over the world. And meanwhile, if you steal some cigarettes, you could get gunned down. If you run a light and you get the wrong cop who pulls you over, you could be shot in your seat. Like, you could suffer lifelong consequences for almost nothing. And it seems like, I think Eddie Izzard sort of pointed this out, it's like once your crimes reach a certain like turning point, we just don't have the capacity mentally, emotionally, certainly in terms of government, the judiciary, to really take stock of it. And so, well, look, we could run through Vietnam and Cambodia and Chile and Argentina and Bangladesh, all the horrific things that he did. And perhaps we'll mention some of that, but it is just amazing that he never had to pay any price. He never showed any remorse. I want to read a quote. This was it was very recent. So Ted Koppel was doing this like retrospective for his 100th birthday or whatever. And he asked him about the bombing of Cambodia. Not super aggressive questions, just questions. And this is what Kissinger said. This is a program you're doing because I'm going to be 100 years old and you're picking a topic of something that happened 60 years ago. You have to know that it was a necessary step. Now the younger generation feels that if they can raise their emotions, they don't have to think. If they think, they won't ask that question. Yeah, like, why are you bringing up old stuff? Why are you bringing up old genocides? What genocides have I done in the last year or two, really? Like, that's how he, I guess, I don't know, insulates himself from what should be lifelong horror. He should not have slept for the last half century. And you young people who think that we should think critically about the actions that were taken by our officials. No, you're just being emotional. You're being emotional about the millions of dead. You should be intellectual, like a sociopath about them. You shouldn't have any emotional reaction whatsoever. So, and that was like yesterday. Like at the end, he still, at least publicly, would not admit to any remorse or responsibility for any of it. Jordan.
Yeah, oh my God, my cat is getting in front of the camera.
That has never happened on the show before. Today truly is a historic day.
Just great timing, Thana. Thank you. There's definitely a two-tier justice system in this country, like you're talking about. And people in power, whether it's Kissinger or even people like Trump or, you know, the Clintons or Hunter Biden, you know, wherever you fall on the political spectrum, you recognize it. People don't face any punishment, really. Even with the insider trading in Congress, that seems so blatant, nobody faces any repercussions.
Yeah.
But for this, sure, definitely didn't face any international punishment, in part because the U.S. is effectively withdrawn from the ICC. But it's also just that we didn't know about the depths and the scale for years, because access journalists, you know, not certainly not a new phenomenon, they covered for him because they wanted to retain that access so they can continue getting stories, getting interviews. We didn't know about it because they lied about it. They denied involvement. And only later did investigative journalists find out just how bad it goes. Even recently, we learned about the innocent death tolls being even greater than what was previously estimated.
Yeah.
So the lack of transparency, the reliance on access by journalists making this problem worse, covering for horrible people in our government. You know, the reason younger generations are so outraged by it in some part is because they're just learning about it getting worse. So it's that he even was pressed on it is shocking, but good. That's a rarity when you look at his entire career. Nobody really did that.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly took a very long time. And look, obviously, it was a lot easier for the government to hide things. And, you know, an earlier phase, of American history, there was far less real journalism, far less independent journalism going on. That made it easier. People to enthusiastically bought into, you know, jingoistic arguments for why we need to do stuff. Obviously, it has been a centuries long project to try to get Americans to give a damn about anyone who isn't exactly like them. That's a project that continues and isn't going very well even at present. So you can imagine how hard it was to get people fired up about the wanton slaughter of non-Americans around the globe decades ago. But yeah, at least today, there will be some. There will be some criticism. There will be some raw conversation. And no doubt, there will be attacks on the people who engage in that. So let's briefly pause as we're discussing Kissinger's death to just talk about a bit of our philosophy, because it seems like, Jordan, you're on the same page as me on this. You're often told not to criticize people when they pass, no matter how bad they were. You're the bad person if you point out the horrific things that they did. If you show any schadenfreude or whatever in the death of a horrific person, a criminal, a war criminal, then you're the bad person. You should be showing more decorum and showing respect. And clearly, we don't agree with that necessarily. But what are your thoughts about whenever that argument is deployed?
That doesn't faze me at all. You can't tell me who I can and can't celebrate or grieve or whatever. It's just very weird. And it's only applied to, you know, politically powerful people that they were friends with, that they needed access from. Like, it's ridiculous. They would never do that for really anybody else. Certainly nobody powerless. They're evil people eventually die. That's a reality. Like, you don't suddenly become good because you die. And it's so weird to me that everyone has this need, especially people in the media or in politics, have this knee-jerk reaction when someone dies, even if they are objectively horrible. And, you know, if they're doing that, I think that reflects certainly how they see this person, how they see, in this context, U.S. foreign policy and the military-industrial complex. They don't care about people around the world. They go back to the jingoism that you talked about. It is interesting, though. I think people were primed and ready for it. And you have seen a couple Democratic members of Congress, not even members of the squad, although I'm sure they're relieved or happy or have the same views as us. But Jim McGovern, for example, like, not like a super progressive firebrand. He's out there tweeting that Kissinger's legacy is a bloody one and that people shouldn't be really trying to whitewash anything that he has done. There have been a few others, and that's unique. But then you have just kind of the even apolitical brands, like the New York Yankees, tweeting out messages and condolences and then how they're going to miss him. Just stick to... This is the case where it's like, yeah, stick to sports, please. What are you doing?
I don't understand. Like, rightly, you know, I'm blanking on his name now, which actually makes me the kid who shot the protesters. Oh my God, I'm blanking his name. It's either dad, dad's brain. Kyle Rittenhouse is going to for the rest of his life, be dogged by the fact that he did that. And he should be, because he did that and it's horrific. Why is it controversial to point out when someone has been responsible for literally millions of more times more death? I don't understand that, except that, again, like, as you pointed out, they're being protected largely by their friends, by people who needed them for something, who owe them something, and who, like Kissinger, on a fundamental level, don't care about the suffering and the death. Maybe on some level, hypothetical, but it doesn't really mean anything to them that this did, that these countries are still trying to recover from the horrors of 40, 50, 60 years ago. Like, they just fundamentally don't care. And so they use, you know, this facade of respectability politics to get you to shut up about stuff that should be core to your values. That if you can't identify that what he did is evil, and if you don't feel like you should speak out about it, then what the hell are you doing in any of this? Like, there should be no controversy whatsoever. And by the way, like, as I said, it became easier to be critical of him as time went on. And so I want to give credit to a quote that admittedly many people in the audience are going to be familiar with, but something that was written 22 years ago by Anthony Bourdain, back in his autobiography, way back in 2001. He said, "Once you've been to Cambodia, you'll never stop wanting to beat Henry Kissinger to death with your bare hands. You will never again be able to open a newspaper and read about that treacherous, prevaricating, murderous scumbag sitting down for a nice chat with Charlie Rose or attending some black tie affair for a new glossy magazine without choking. Witness what Henry did in Cambodia, the fruits of his genius for statesmanship, and you will never understand why he's not sitting in the dock at The Hague next to Milosevic." And that was, you know, obviously more controversial back in 2001. I don't think he'd get much criticism now, but he stuck with it. In 2018, he said, "Frequently, I've come to regret things I've said. This from 2001 is not one of those times." And he was right. Just look, there can be like a needlessly edgy thing where anyone who dies, you could mine their past and find something that isn't necessarily reflective of the sum total of their life. But this is his life. This is what Kissinger did. And it would be super bizarre not to point that out. And you don't have to be at quite as bad as Kissinger. You know, when Dick Cheney kicks the bucket or whatever, you need to point out the things that he did. Donald Trump, we're not going to have a day of respectability. We're not going to pretend that the things that we experienced didn't happen. Okay. To do that is to give to other horrific people what they want. And to allow people like this to continue to exist. You know, the lines have to be drawn somewhere, but making it more difficult, even marginally more difficult for horrific people to live the placid, happy life that they want to live, that is not on you to make that happen. And I would argue the exact opposite is our ethical responsibility if we actually hold the values that we pretend to. Sorry. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I think the media's role in cementing the legacy of these people is something they should take seriously. And, you know, I'm relieved people like Spencer Ackerman at Rolling Stone, who has a great obituary out now titled "Henry Kissinger, War Criminal, Beloved by America's Ruling Class, Finally Dies." And in it, he argues that his obituary and his legacy should be cemented as one defined by all of these atrocities, not his service just being in the government for many years and not any facade of diplomacy, because ultimately many of these efforts were undermined by Kissinger and through back channels. So that should be his legacy. And if the media wants to do that, that I think would be the responsible path. But unfortunately, many of them just try to create this illusion that we're all just, you know, bickering on policy ideas. That's it. And bipartisanship is healthy and robust. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's service and love to this country that matters. And I don't buy that. I don't think many people watching, and I would hope more people didn't buy into that, because that nationalistic myth is what protects people like this. when you are more worried about maintaining any sort of respectability when someone like this dies and not centering the people, the millions of people whose lives have been affected or ended because of him, you're only going to pave the way for more people like him. And that's a really dangerous game.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And for the people who think that, like, that really think you should be nice when the person dies, live a life that doesn't lead to people wanting to pillory you after you've died. I don't think it's actually as hard as they're implying it is with their defense of people like Henry Kissinger. Anyway, obviously we had a lot to say about that. I wish I could get to Mike Johnson's defense of him, but there's no time. We have to take our first break. When we come back though, in honor of Henry Kissinger, we're going to talk about war crimes on the other side of this. Okay, we're going to continue talking about war crimes with this.
We've had Defense Minister Gallant, "We will eliminate everything." An IDF spokesperson, "Our focus is on damage, not on precision." Agriculture Minister Avi Dichter, "We are now rolling out the Gaza Nakba, Gaza Nakba 2023. That's how it'll end." Israeli Heritage Minister Amichai Lau said a nuclear bomb is, quote, "one of the possibilities." Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, "We need sterile zones in the West Bank." Israeli President Isaac Herzog, "It's an entire nation out there that is responsible. This rhetoric about civilians not aware, not involved, it's absolutely not true. They could have risen up. They could have fought against that evil regime." Another former Knesset member, "There is one and only solution, which is to completely destroy Gaza before invading it. I mean destruction like what happened in Dresden and Hiroshima without nuclear weapons." Would you join us in condemning that as well?
So I condemn nothing that the Israeli government is doing.
Which I guess knowing Ted Cruz is hardly a surprise. It's difficult to watch though when Ryan Grimm so expertly lays out all of these utterly unacceptable comments from officials and former officials on the Israeli side. Saying that, no. Like, I know some people say that it's just like an accident or whatever, or it's just because of the human shields. No, we want to kill as many people as possible. Now, that is not everyone, obviously, in the Israeli government, and plenty of officials never say anything like that. But many have, as he just shotgunned through all of those comments. And that was not enough to get Ted Cruz to back off of his unflagging defense of the current military strategy. Not of like the idealistic, like the ideal strategy for dealing with Hamas, or, you know, accepting like, oh, there's been some horrific accidents, but like the overall mission is still, no, he's fine with what's happening right now. And Ryan Grimm is going to press him, but it's not going to work. Take a look.
There is a qualitative difference. The Israeli government does not target civilians. They target military targets. The Israeli government
is so bad at their targeting then if they're killing so many civilians.
So they're actually not. They are.
So then they are targeting.
No, they're exceptionally good at. So I can tell you there is no military on the face of the planet, including the US military, that goes to the lengths that the Israeli military does to avoid civilian casualties. So I'll give you.
But the IDF said our focus is on damage, not on precision.
Yes, we damage keep to Hamas, different- damage to Hamas, to terrorists. And I am all for.
They have said that, the opposite. They keep saying that what they're doing is what they're intending to do. And here in the United States, we say that's not what they're doing.
That's simply not true.
Yeah, Ted Cruz remains, as always, a possum-faced weenie. Okay, what he actually believes is, I don't care that the civilians are dying. And to his credit, he's advocating for more of them to continue to die because he doesn't think the military strategy needs to change at all. But he is fleeing, tail tucked between his legs, from the indisputable quotes that Ryan Grimm is saying. The quote was not, we don't care about precision, we want damage to Hamas. It's, we don't care about precision, we want damage. That's a defense of what's happening. And again, doesn't mean that that's what everyone believes. And you can have, I guess, some sort of nuanced argument for why we should find acceptable the fact that over 15,000 civilians have died. But that's not what Ted Cruz is doing. He's saying this is good. They're good at targeting. It doesn't matter that the 15,000 have died. They're doing a bang up job. There's no notes. Just keep it going. Current sitting senator. Jordan, what do you think?
If this is an issue that Ken Klippenstein and I just talked about on my podcast yesterday. So we have a ton of new information around the civilian death toll. And in comparison, the New York Times surprisingly did a decent story sizing it up to similar conflicts. But the people quoted in there, I'm talking former Pentagon advisors, were talking about how horrific this is. In part, it's because of the size and the scale of the weapons used in such a densely populated area. They're using 2,000-pound bombs in Gaza, which in places like Jabalia refugee camp is one of the most densely populated places on earth. They're saying they're doing this to take out underground infrastructure, but they don't show any regard for the people living there. Dropping leaflets or just releasing social media messages isn't effective when you've cut off communications for people and they don't have anywhere to go, because they're also still, by their own admission, bombing places in South Gaza. But for the historical comparison, we're on pace to pass the civilian death toll from Afghanistan. This is 20 years of conflict in just a couple months. Think about that. 20 years in Afghanistan and the civilian death toll in Gaza is already poised to surpass that in just a couple months.
Yep.
There is no tactic. There is no caution. There is no concern. This is deliberate. And of course, like you said, it's not surprising that Ted Cruz would defend it, but that there isn't any outcry from the majority of the Democratic Party, that the Biden administration that tried to frame at the beginning of their tenure, their international relations and foreign policy approach as uplifting and protecting human rights. There's right now, even despite these numbers, are set to lift all restrictions on U.S. weapon stockpiles that Israel has access to there. Yeah. They've tried to cover up what arms we're giving to Israel. They have no real concern or regard for people who are living there. And it's like you see in some of these comments from Israeli officials, those are certainly adopted even maybe quietly by U.S. officials. They're all complicit. And that's just how they see it. They do not care about people who die there.
I don't understand how we cannot all come together around the idea that it is unacceptable to talk about nuking Gaza. I understand that we are in divided, partisan times. I feel like we should all be able to agree that you can't nuke Gaza. But Ted Cruz cannot agree on that. He could say, that's obviously crazy, but that's not what we're seeing. They're just dropping 2,000. He doesn't even do that. He won't condemn talking about nuking a densely populated urban area that you can't leave. And this is, again, as I always point out, this is not, a conversation on October 8th, hypothetical about is it acceptable to start to drop these bombs. This is after 15,000 deaths, and he has no problem with it. He is an utter sociopath and a coward, as I pointed out. And I just want to quickly buttress what Jordan was saying. Washington Post said some great, these, by the way, are out of date. The numbers are worse now. Thousands more have died. But for when it was just 4,000 children who had been killed in 1 month, this was a comparison of children killed in major conflicts, casualties over time. And you can see there's no comparison for how many children had been killed in as short a span of time. Yes, way more children have died in Syria. And God, I hope we don't pass those numbers, although there's every reason to believe that within a few months we will. But that was after over 100 months. This is 1 month. And you can see the monthly average child casualties and conflicts. The comparison is to Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, Iraq, devastating, horrific wars. And they barely register on the chart. And Ted Cruz, a guy who is pro-life, no problem with it. No problem whatsoever. Jordan, I want to give you a chance for a final comment, but also I want to make sure that people can listen to your conversation with Ken Klippenstein. So could you start by telling people where they could hear that?
Yeah. So the show is called The Insurgents. It's at insurgentspod.com or any podcast provider. I thought it was a really good conversation. One of the parts that he also brought up was the tactic question, right? So they're using an aerial campaign in a densely populated area. And that is something the U.S. has certainly shifted to over the past few decades, because it's much easier to sell that war domestically because you don't have as many of your troops coming home in body bags. You don't have them coming back in caskets. So when you're just dropping bombs on people who have nowhere to go or in densely populated areas, and you're not sending in as many ground forces, they're certainly not going into the tunnels, and they certainly didn't at the onset. It's easier to sell this war in perpetuity. It's easier to create a sense of forever war. And that's what the US has done. That's what Israel's doing here. Mm-hmm. And Israeli officials have made it quite clear after this resumes, after this temporary pause ends, they're going to resume what they were doing, and it's going to be even worse. The defense minister made that clear last week. So it's on everyone to fight for a permanent ceasefire. If you're concerned about the hostages, which every pro-Israel and pro-IDF talking head in the media uses as their first line of justification for what Israel is doing in Gaza. They took hostages. Okay. And a ceasefire is what's bringing them back. So yeah. Why aren't you joining this call for a ceasefire? You could read into that about people's character, what they want, what their outcomes, their desired outcomes are. But it seems like it's not really about the hostages, is it?
No. And yeah, as someone who does actually care about them coming back, I can't tell you how happy I am that it has been extended the several times that it has, and that we've had more days of transfers. And I would love to see that happen until all the hostages and prisoners that shouldn't be in prison have been transferred. But there are other people who, as you point out, are just, they're champing at the bit to get this started again. And as you alluded to earlier in our conversation, we've already been told about how the ramping up of the bombing in South Gaza has been previewed. We did a video about it. Which unfortunately most people don't see because it's one of the things that makes me most sick to my stomach. Nobody really seems to care about what's happening over in Gaza and Israel. So people don't watch videos, but anyway, we're going to talk about it regardless. People were told flee to the south, flee to the south, flee to the south. And now the bombing is going to be coming to the south. So we're going to update these numbers at some point, and I can't even conceive of what they're going to look like in a couple of months. Anyway, we have to, I think we're going to take our next break because our next story is going to be very long. There's a lot of video, but understandably so. I just want to end by just pointing out, just because I wanted your very quick reaction, Jordan. Mehdi Hassan's show, it was just announced, is being canceled, which seems like, since it was one of the few that did critical, hard-hitting, dogged interviews, I just imagine you might have thoughts. So briefly, what do you think about that?
I am actually really glad you brought that up. And it underscores the importance of outlets, progressive outlets, independent outlets that will actually talk about these things in ways that aren't just deferential to the US government or the security state or the military industrial complex. He was great. Amon's also really good. I don't want to act like Mehdi was the only voice, because Amon on MSNBC is also pretty good.
Yes.
But Mehdi is just like, he's so sharp. And it honestly seems deliberate. I think back to Phil Donahue being canned for being critical of the war on terror. At the New York Times, Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize winner, also got canned for being critical of the war. But if you cheerlead the war, if you justify every single decision and action, the US military, or in this case, the Israeli military with the US's support, is doing, your job is safe. And yeah. Think about the role the media plays in selling these wars to people. So it's not just TYT that you should support. I'm thankful for everyone that does. And you're not going to hear this on other YouTube channels or other progressive and independent media outlets that are really in it for themselves, but try to co-opt some of this language to seem like they're in this fight. You really do need to support more than just your preferred network or outlet. Because there are a ton of, like, the Majority Report is really great. Breaking Points, I think, is decent. You know, Ryan Grimm's show is pretty good. I think that also might be in the Breaking Points network. The Lever is really good. But think about a handful of outlets that do good reporting, ask tough questions, and when they have the opportunity, because a lot of these people won't talk to progressive outlets, when they have that opportunity, really meaningfully push back. That was something Mehdi was great at, and I would assume that's why he was pushed out.
Yeah. And that definitely is an issue that so many people won't go on progressive outlets. That's 100% true. But you're right. And didn't he, just like within the last week, he had an interview with, I believe, an Israeli official that got like a ton of news coverage, didn't Mehdi?
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sure there'll be a story about why they had to can him. And who knows, maybe he'll get another show in a different time slot or something like that. But I'm not seeing that. The announcements about what's to come doesn't include that. And you're right. He's not the only person who's doing good work, but the particular thing that he brings, he is the best at on mainstream sort of like centrist Democratic network. So yeah, that is unfortunate to see. And as you point out, it's not the first time something like this has happened. There's definitely a pattern. I mean, you could throw Cenk into that as well. Not particularly for criticisms of war efforts, but criticisms of the Obama administration. And he was canned for that. So yeah. And weirdly, young people don't want to watch those networks that much. I wonder why. Anyway, with that said, we do have to take a break. We'll be back with more. Okay, really fast. I am being fact checked and I take fact checks very seriously. You know, I don't mind being criticized, but I am being told that possums are not mammals, they're marsupials. And I'm pretty sure marsupials are mammals. I'm not like an Animal Planet guy or anything, but I'm pretty sure that they're mammals. Anyway, let's see if we can get a poll going or something. I think that's how science works. Anyway, with that said, we have a lot to get to and it's weird. Let's jump into it.
There's a public perception that that was part of an apology tour, if you will. That this had been said online. There was all of the criticism. There was advertisers leaving. We talked to Bob Iger today.
I hope they stop.
You hope?
Don't advertise.
You don't want them to advertise?
No.
What do you mean?
If somebody's going to try to blackmail me with advertising, blackmail me with money, go f*** yourself.
But
go yourself. Is that clear? I hope it is. Hey, Bob, if you're in the audience.
I'm not sure that there has ever been a bigger gap between a person's self-image and who they actually are to others. God, was that cringy and try hard. They're repeating it, trying to get a reaction. Just the way he's sitting. Man, he thinks that he's clever and edgy and tough. And I mean, it's impossible to get through to him, but Jesus. Anyway, so he's saying that, he doesn't even care that advertisers have fled Twitter because of his anti-Semitic comments. Doesn't seem true considering he's trying to sue Media Matters because he thinks they're responsible for it. So he's like, I'm not crying at all, but he clearly is. But what bothers me is less him telling the advertisers to F off. I don't care about the advertisers or about his platform. Is anybody else noticing how weird he's acting in this video? I'm going to play a little bit more. And I just want you to like see his body language, the pauses, how awkward the entire thing is. Take a look at this.
If you believe that this is the one part of your business where you will be beholden to those who have this view, what do you do?
F Y.
I understand that, but there's a reality too, right?
Yes. No. No.
Linda Yaccarino is right here, and she's got to sell advertising.
Absolutely. So, totally. So, no. Actually, what this advertising boycott is going to do? It's going to kill the company.
And you think that the
and the whole world will know that those advertisers killed the company, and we will document it in great detail.
He's going to continue on whatever he thinks that point is. And look, there's a lot there that, Jordan, we need to dive into, like what he thinks the definition of blackmail is, the fact that the CEO is telling the world that the $44 billion social media purchase he made is going to die. There's a lot of issues there, but just again, I don't watch him all the time. And I understand that I am biased. I despise him more than perhaps anyone else in the world. But does it not seem like he's either in the grip of like existential depression or some sort of chemical that had the feel of like last words to me? I don't know. Maybe I'm exaggerating. What do you think, Jordan?
It strikes me as somebody who has filled positions at various companies that he controls, filled those positions with people who are just yes men and yes women. And everything that he has said, everything that he has done, everything he thinks that will elicit a positive reaction, they will happily oblige because they want to keep their jobs. you saw kind of the try hard behavior during that initial few months, really tumultuous period at Twitter, where you had people, I'm sleeping in the office because I love working at Twitter so much and I think Elon's great. And then they were ultimately let go and people were just reportedly working over holidays and weekends to keep him happy and meet his eccentric demands. He has cultivated a culture there where people will just say yes and laugh to everything that he says and does. And playing out here, the simplest explanation for me is that you're in a room where you are saying nonsensical things about business practices in a room filled with people who are there to think about, hear about business practices. And that's not going to play there. And then he admits it eventually. Oh yeah, this advertiser boycott, the primary source of revenue for this company, it's going to kill us if it dissipates. And just 30 seconds prior, he was saying, GFY, and I don't want your advertisers, to one of the biggest advertisers on the planet. Good luck. No one's going to laugh to that because they only see you as a failure.
Yeah, I have tried for years to get through to people that he is not the genius that you have been sold that he is. And I'm wasting my time. It's clearly not going to work. But like, this guy is the CEO of six different companies because he's apparently an expert on coding, automobile manufacturer, rockets, tunneling, social media, all of that. He definitely knows about all of those things. And he's really involved in their activities on a daily basis as he's tweeting for 16 hours a day. But there he's saying effectively, he takes no responsibility for the advertisers wanting to leave the platform. And by the way, maybe they left because of the anti-Semitic comments. I don't know. I don't even think that was necessary. They should be leaving because the platform has been turned into a living hell that nobody wants to be on, which seems like a problem. But in response to that, his reaction is to throw a hissy fit in front of advertisers and say, well, whatever, it'll kill the company. And then the consolation is supposed to be that not that he can save the company. He doesn't have any ideas. So yes, you should keep him as your CEO of Tesla and all that. This is a guy who just gives up as a result of not wanting to take responsibility for his own behavior. But his consolation is that he'll be liked more than them. Take a look at this.
Those advertisers, I imagine, are going to say, they're going to say, we didn't kill the company.
Oh yeah.
They're going to say,
tell it to Earth.
But they're going to say that, they're going to say, Elon, that you killed the company because you said these things and that they were inappropriate things and that they didn't feel comfortable on the platform, right? That's what they're going to say.
And let's see how Earth responds to that.
What is any of this supposed to mean? He thinks, yeah, well, I don't want them to come back. And it might kill this $44 billion investment, but whatever. Earth will be on my side. But yeah, but he doesn't care. He goes on to say in the interview, I have no problem being hated, which might be the biggest lie ever. There has been no, even Trump doesn't crave adulation and praise as much as Elon Musk. But this is a guy that apparently is willing to let the company die rather than change course because people will blame Disney more than him or whatever. I don't even know. And this is a guy who's clearly going through a bunch of stuff. There had been reporting a couple of weeks back that Twitter staff almost called the cops during one of his tantrums because he'd locked himself in his office at Twitter and they were worried he was going to hurt himself. And that was apparently in the wake of when he got booed at the Dave Chappelle concert because he honestly believed that he would go on stage and everyone would cheer for him. Because as Jordan points out, he surrounds himself with people who've been chosen just because they love him or at least will pretend that they do. This is his personal problem. It should just be his personal problem that ideally you go to therapy for. But instead, he's put in charge of all of these different companies that he's not qualified to run. He's not psychologically capable of running. And we're just watching this. And I honestly, like, I'm very critical of him and everything. But like, this feels like the sort of thing that is a warning sign of something bad that could happen soon. I don't want to be an alarmist or whatever, but this is a public meltdown on a scale that we don't often see. It's like he's got apocalyptic dark thoughts that he is putting out onto Disney, but that are his to deal with. This is a response to his actions and statements, and he takes no responsibility, as he never does. Any final thoughts?
It's funny to see, like you said, people are more and more seeing through his facade. He's not this uniquely skilled genius who can run every company efficiently. He certainly has no idea what he's doing. He's tanking this platform. He bought it because he wanted to be popular and well-liked on it. And the let's let Earth decide thing, again, just seems like his echo chamber of people who will just say, oh, great, masterful gambit, sir, brilliant, sir, to everything that he tweets or does. That's who he expects to take his side. And later he was pressed on the Disney thing. He implied that everybody would just boycott Disney in retaliation. Nobody's going to do that. People do not care. And especially on the right, where most of his base is now, they definitely aren't going to care. They're not going to like stick with it long enough, because the next movie that comes along or the next opportunity to go to a park, and they're certainly not going to stop watching ESPN. Like, they're going to engage with Disney in one way or another.
Yeah. Yeah, the closest you can come to a boycott of Disney is Jordan's refusal to watch MCU movies, but that's really it at this point.
Still going strong.
Still going strong. Anyway, we are running out of time, but I want to talk more about cars and whether they'll be made. Let's jump into this.
We've shown the world that this industry is harming workers and consumers to the benefit of company executives and the rich. And it's time that the working class did something about it. To all the auto workers out there working without the benefits of a union, now it's your turn. So go to uaw.org/join.
So fresh off of really big victories with negotiations with Ford and GM and Stellantis, the United Auto Workers, the UAW, is now going to the next phase. And that is their attempt to unionize 150,000 plus workers across 13 different automakers. Massive names: Tesla, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, Hyundai. And so there is reason to believe that this could succeed, because they played hardball with these three big companies. They won massive gains for the workers. So if you're the workers at these other companies, you're probably thinking, I would kind of like a massive bump in my pay and benefits and all of that. So anyway, while we have Jordan on the show, I had to ask you about this, because I know this is the sort of thing that you follow quite a bit. What do you think about this next phase in the UAW's activism?
I think it's great. The proof is there. You see people's material conditions improving as a result of collective bargaining, organizing your workplace, and striking together and remaining firm in that. And the outcome was great for UAW workers, just like it was for UPS workers, and just like it was for many, many unions around the country over the past couple of years. They're showing more and more people around the world, or especially or around the country, but definitely around the world, are realizing, hey, when we do this, we start to get a bigger slice of the pie. It's no longer most of the money going to the top. We start to get comfortable raises. We can start to live a comfortable life. We finally have economic security from our labor that they are profiting off of. I love it. I love the way the UAW has operated over the past couple months. The president has been captivating in how he's run that union. Let's leave it at that. I love the direction they're taking, and I would love to see more car plants unionized.
Yeah, the change in strategy about how they actually do the strikes, I thought was just fascinating to watch, and obviously very effective. They won workers an average of about 25% raise over 4 years, and a number of other benefits, and getting to maximum wages faster. And we've already seen ripple effects that have helped a lot of workers who are not at unionized auto manufacturers, including VW, Nissan, Hyundai, Honda, Toyota, and Subaru. They've raised their wages after this because they're worried about it coming to them next. But anyway, considering prior efforts to unionize some of these auto manufacturers, including Tesla, have been unsuccessful because, you know, people like Elon Musk absolutely despise workers and humans in general. They find them to be an unfortunate inconvenience that they'd love to replace with robots, but can't just yet. I love having vigorous leadership at the UAW, and I can't wait to see how successful they are in winning gains for so many more workers who are doing important and difficult work. That is unfortunately all the time we have for the first hour of the show. Huge stories that we've had to jump into. For those of you who are on the live show, though, there's more to come in the aftermath, including George Santos. He has like one last chance to get something done in Congress, perhaps. Wait until you see what it is. And then we're going to jump into media double standards on what you're allowed to say about the other side. Some work by Media Matters that I found to be fascinating. And did BLM endorse Donald Trump? We're going to weigh the evidence. We'll be back in just a few. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.